Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at UH1.com.
Welcome to Unscrewed, the show that knows that real liberation includes sexual liberation. I am Jacqueline Friedman. This week, I thought it was more than time. It was half past time to take a deeper dive, given SESTA / FOSTA was signed into law this week, and the SB 1204 that I was talking about on last week's show. Basically, if you don't know what's been going on, go listen to the last few episodes and get caught up. But we're in a major moment where sex work in specific is being criminalized at a new level and a new dangerous pace. And I thought it would be good to take a moment and take stock of how we got here and what it all means and how maybe we can get to a better place. And so I'm really thrilled to be talking today to someone that I was just introduced to, but seems like the perfect person to talk to about this. Her name is Claudia Cochicaro, and she is a criminologist who specializes in studying and thinking about sex and sex work. So, Claudia, thanks for coming on Unscrewed.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, you are definitely the person I want to talk to about this stuff. But before we get into it, as you know, on Unscrewed, we put all our guests through the lightning round just to get to know you a little. So the first question is, what has been making you happy this week?
Oh, I got some books.
Oh, yeah? Are you reading anything good? Anything you want to recommend?
Let me see. Yes, Not a Crime to Be Poor by Peter Edelman.
All right. Excellent.
It's a little controversial, but a little controversy didn't hurt anyone, right?
Well, that's not strictly true, but books definitely do make me happy. All right. Second question is, what is the best sex advice or some of the best sex advice you ever received?
I think it's about engaging in kink.
Yeah.
Like in BDSM. That's the best sex advice that I've ever had.
That someone suggested you try it? What was the advice?
I don't know if it's a suggestion to try it. It's good to work therapeutically, work through trauma, actually.
Who told you that? Do you remember?
My psychiatrist.
Oh, excellent. Good for them. All right, this next question I feel like is kind of probably the answer is what we're going to talk about on the show, but I ask it to everybody. Like, what's been making you the maddest or saddest around the sexual culture lately?
I think what makes me upset, it really makes me angry, and it's really hard to get me angry. But what really upsets me is the passing of SESTA FOSTA as a survivor of trafficking in the sex industry. I know how dangerous this can be. And I believe that we will see a lot of bad consequences, terrible consequences for most marginalized people.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, fourth question is, what is a myth or a wrong thing about sex that you used to believe but you don't believe anymore?
Sex is bad. Sex is supposed to be enjoyed only by a select group of people, those who are married, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I used to think that women did not have sex on their own terms.
That left to our own devices, women would not ever want to have sex.
It's more like women could not have sex on their own terms. It was just a way that I think I was raised and I was socialized.
Yeah.
I'm not certain that this is the same for everybody, but I believe this may be a possibility. It's like it may be how a lot of women feel, that they're not supposed to enjoy sex on their own terms.
Yeah, absolutely. We talk about that a lot on this show. And then lastly, who is someone who you want to give a shout out to, who you think is doing really brave or good work to unscrew the sexual culture?
Kate D'Adamo.
Kate D'Adamo?
Yeah.
Yeah, tell us about her. I've met her a couple times, but I don't know that the audience knows her.
Kate D'Adamo is a policy advisor. She has been doing great work organizing, the grassroots organizing and policy to support policy that helps sex workers and absolutely marginalized groups like LGBTQ and other, particularly trans sex workers, actually.
Do you remember the name of the org she's working for? I've seen her quoted everywhere on the SESTA conversation. She is doing amazing stuff, but I'm blanking on the name right now.
I think she used to work for a sex workers project in New York, but I think she may be affiliated with Freedom Network. I think she does a lot of independent work.
Got it.
At this point.
All right. Well, we'll link to some of her stuff in the show notes at jacquelinefriedman.com so you can find her. Awesome. Well, that's the lightning round. Thanks for indulging me. So this is a tough topic.
Yes, indeed.
Where should we dive in? I don't think that the folks listening need to have a basic explanation of SESTA FOSTA because mm-hmm. we've been talking about it on the show these last few weeks. But what I do kind of want to do is give folks a sense of, like, a deeper sense of what you think is to come with these laws being passed, and also some historical context, right? When did the narrative shift? I feel like there's been a shift to sort of, or maybe it's just been a shift in my awareness, so you can correct me. Mm. Have laws about sex work always conflated sort of consensual or voluntary sex work and trafficking? Or is that a new sort of, I feel like there was this shift maybe in the late 90s in feminist discourse, especially about, like, because we couldn't just say prostitution is bad anymore, we just sort of started saying everybody's a victim of trafficking instead. Is that right? Is that a new conflation, or was trafficking and sex work always conflated?
The idea of trafficking appeared periodically across time ever since the white slave panic, late 1800s. And then Jessica Pliley has, she's a historian, has a formidable book on the Mann Act. It's called Policing Sexuality. She talks about the Mann Act and how the Mann Act was used, and today is still used to police movement of women to criminalize extramarital sex.
And what does the Mann Act say? Do you know? Like, what is it? Is it a federal law?
Yeah. Basically, the Mann Act says that transporting a woman for sexual purposes across state lines is trafficking. And it generally is used to prosecute people who are crossing state lines for prostitution in exchange for something of value. Like, if you cross state lines and you got kind of caught, you know, in a hotel room with somebody and they exchange sex for something of value, it doesn't necessarily explain what that something of value is, but, you know, could be money, could be anything, then you could be trafficked.
It could be dinner?
Yeah.
I give up.
It's very wide, this interpretation. You can interpret it in any way possible. It's at the latitude of the prosecutor, I believe. So the Mann Act is one of those things that was used in early 1900s to the police women's movement and the sexuality across the United States. Later on, we had this radical feminist movement, the Andrea Dworkin, the mm-hmm. Catherine McKinnon, the anti-pornography, the women against pornography, the likes of Gloria Steinem and the rest. It's probably sometime in the 90s. That's about the time when the discourse started changing from prostitution, pornography to trafficking, so more like female sexual slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This is a term that's coming from Catherine Barry. She had a book about sex work prostitution is female sexual slavery.
That all prostitution is female sexual slavery?
Essentially, according to this group, yes.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, there is absolutely no evidence to support that. There's no scientific evidence to support such a simplistic description of prostitution or sex work.
Well, I think it makes it easier on a certain set of people to oppose sex work if we conceive of specifically women who engage in sex work as having no agency and being in need of rescue sort of across the board. It's just easier to conceive of for folks who have, I think, a gut level distaste for sex work for whatever reasons than to think like, oh, these women are choosing this and I don't understand why, right? Like I think there's like a cognitive discomfort that's easily resolved when you just cast all of those women as victims. Does that track with your work?
Yes, it works because of this idea of victimhood has been constructed on a pre-existent framework. If you remember in the 80s, there was this battered women's movement, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Research done around that time erroneously posited that women could not leave abusive relationships because of something called learned helplessness, that they just got used to the situation and they would not perceive it as abuse anymore. In reality, there are other factors that influence these choices. It has nothing to do with learned helplessness. It has something to do with the inefficient system that's put in place to allegedly help women get out. Right? There is no safety net. There is women being isolated from their families and friends. They really have nowhere to go, and the state doesn't really help much apart from sending people to several counseling sessions or, it depends on the state. So, that was the framework used. Like, these women were battered. They didn't know any better. They were victims of truly deviant, abusive men. And that was used in a lot of prosecutions, but it created also this toxic and unhealthy environment of assigned victimhood. Whereas, like, as long as you were the right type of victim,
mm-hmm.
you were given rewards. You were rewarded for that. Like, the case could be won. And we have the victims' rights movement in California. We know the consequences of that. In between the political actions and the lobbying of the correctional officers' unions and the victims' rights movement representatives there,
mm-hmm.
there was an unfortunate effect. The mass incarceration, the levels of incarceration in California, which just skyrocketed.
So the discourse shifts to the sort of victim framework, the sort of painting every woman involved in sex work is free of agency and intrinsically a victim. That shift happens in the 90s. So here we are today. Can you give us a little, I know that folks who listen to the show understand what Sesta Fosta are, but one thing I don't know is, like, where did they come from? Like, who wrote these things, and how did we come to this particular moment where it seems like the criminalization of sex work is accelerating at just a really alarming pace all of a sudden?
What I want to point out is not who actually penned or who supported this law, but is what it aims to do and how it came to this law.
Yeah.
If you remember, a while ago, there was this documentary called I Am Jane Doe.
Yes. But not everyone who's listening may remember it. So why don't you talk about it a little?
Right. So I Am Jane Doe is like, it's a documentary priming the audience for an intervention. It creates this artificial need for addressing a problem, right? It tells you that there is a problem. And the problem is sex trafficking of young girls on the internet. Now, trafficking is a process. It involves more than seeing a picture or posting an ad on the internet. That in itself is not trafficking. But when framed like this, like I said, people who are not aware of subtleties tend to believe that, right? They're misdirected. So the social construction of trafficking of Backpage or other sites as trafficking or traffickers it comes from this idea that demand has to be ended. And that is criminalization, is like partial criminalization, right?
It's right.
Allegedly decriminalizing prostitution, decriminalizing the person who is providing the services, and criminalizing the person who engages in buying the services. The Swedish model is also sold to everybody, is also promoted as a gender equality issue, right? Except that it's not Swedish. Catherine MacKinnon took this idea to Rocks in 1990 and gave them that impulse to lobby for what is now called the Swedish model. And once it passed in there, it spread all over the place.
And the Swedish model is a focus on ending demand, right? Yes. Is criminalizing demand.
Yes.
And what's happening in practice? When you look at Sweden, what do you see?
There's research pointing out to increased violence against sex workers. It's women are back in the streets. People are dying because of the destructive elements of stigmatization, increased stigmatization. Women engaged in sex, or anybody who is engaged in sex work, has little time to screen potential customers, or more lenient of who they want to see or who they can see. You know, like they don't have time. They're afraid of the police. The police is not on their side, of course. Customers can demand terrible things, knowing that the women are in need of money. It's completely the opposite of what it says it does. It puts people at risk.
Because any time you criminalize, well, any part of a process, the people who are going to suffer are the people who have the least power, you know, that... Even though they're theoretically criminalizing the customers, mm-hmm. the customers have more sort of...
Yeah, they have the upper hand. I'm putting myself at risk for you.
And a lot of the sex workers are in need, right? They're turning to, you know, I think there's probably some subsection of sex workers who just genuinely like the work and would do it regardless. But there are not, you know, I think a lot of sex workers engage in it because they need the money, not because this is their ideal job.
Absolutely.
Because this is the best option to make the money that they need to survive or to feed their family or whatever. And so that kind of desperation or need can really, regardless of whether the criminalization is legally targeted at the sex worker, mm-hmm. winds up putting the sex worker in greater danger. Do I have that right?
Yep.
Okay.
I mean, it's like once you take away a person's source of income, whether it is selling cookies...
Right.
Or selling sex, there's this unrealistic expectation that somebody is just going to turn to something else because it's so easy to do it. It's not. There's women who are engaged in survival sex work, and I keep saying women, but I should just refer to other populations like queer and non-binary and gender non-conforming people and trans people, people who are really marginalized, who are extremely poor, who are scared, who really have nowhere to go, because believe it or not, we still live in a society where your appearance is dictating what kind of job you're getting.
Right. Well, and a lot of them already have criminal records from engaging in sex work. And so the idea of just going and getting another job is hindered by that as well. You know, if they thought they had better options for supporting themselves than sex work, they would be doing those better options.
Absolutely, absolutely. I have students who came out in class and confessed, saying there is no other way. There are things that are happening out there that prevented them from going to get a job, a regular job, where you're likely to be equally harassed and abused and yelled at and even raped in many cases as you are in this criminalized situations like sex work or drug dealing and stuff like that.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation.
Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
So, as you said, you yourself were a victim of trafficking, actual trafficking.
Yes.
So, this Tessa Fossa is not the right way to go about addressing trafficking. But what
I believe not.
Yeah, I think that we're, yeah. But what is? Like, what should be happening?
So, let me explain why Tessa Fossa is not going to do anything about trafficking. In fact, I think it's going to make it worse. Of course, since this just passed, I have no empirical research to support my statements, but I'll just talk out of experience. So when I was trafficked, I was a teenager. It looks like one of those stories that the anti-trafficking movement sells through their raising awareness campaigns. Just got abducted and... next thing I knew, I was in an apartment with a pimp or a trafficker, his bottom, and two other women. And I was told what was expected of me. And I realized pretty quickly that it was in my best interest to at least pretend that I was down with the program. I gained their trust and I escaped. Later, only to just end up in Japan in the same situation. Unfortunately, for me, I tried to escape several times. This hostess club I was kept in, and it didn't work out because the police brought me back. So I realized pretty early in the situation that I really had only myself.
Wait, you went to the police in Japan and they brought you back to the people who were holding you?
Yes.
Wow. What did they say, can I ask? Why did they say they were doing that?
They would not tell me. I was so dehumanized.
They didn't bother.
They didn't bother to give me an explanation. Like, I was not even a human being to them because I wasn't Japanese, right?
Wow.
And here we found your employee wandering around our station. Next time... keep them locked in. Yeah, so then I tried to do that several times, but the women I was there with, they asked me to stop because to them, this wasn't trafficking. This was a contract. They wanted to work to send money home. So because of their pleading, I just decided that I was just going to put up with it for about 4 or 5 months, whatever long I had left there, and just try to get home, which I did. But unfortunately, two of the people that I was sent there with, they decided to remain and overstay their visa, and terrible things happened to them. And I decided to go back to Japan on a tourist visa and to help them out. And I stayed there for about 10 years, out of which about 7 to 8 I helped women get out of such situation.
Wow. How did you help them? That's sort of one of the questions I'm asked for is what's actually helpful? What would have helped you and how did you help them?
Generally, it's I think in the United States, people refer to this as rescue, but this is not necessarily rescue. I would go to places that I knew they had women working there, from Eastern Europe or foreign looking women, not Japanese. But because the Japanese women, they have a certain level of privilege, right? They're paid well. They don't have to do anything they don't want to. They go to work whenever they want to. These ones, the women coming there on entertainment visas, it's a different story.
Mm.
So I knew where these places were at. And I just created like a network of people like who are going to these places, like clients, and I would go work there, work quote unquote, and would just ask someone whom I could see that it was distraught, or when I wasn't working in these places, I would just distribute. They had phone cards back then, and I would just write with a small marker on the back, call this number. I had like 3 or 4 cell phones that I would rotate periodically. Things like this. It was pretty dangerous, actually.
Yeah. So if I'm a legislator here in the US of A, and I want to do something actually helpful about human trafficking, maybe I specifically want to focus on sex trafficking, what would be a helpful thing for me to do if I'm a legislator, if I, you know, here in the US?
Decriminalize prostitution?
Yeah, talk about how that actually helps anyone who's being trafficked.
All right, so to go back to these experiences that I just explained.
Yeah.
Back then, prostitution in Japan is regulated and tolerated, right? Or at least it was. All kinds of sex work happen in Japan, and it's not necessarily something that it's frowned upon, right? I mean, that there are people who are, of course, morally opposed, and there are people who are not. And whenever something violent happens, if you need the police will intervene. The police will pay attention, much more so than it is here.
If you're Japanese, at least.
If you're Japanese, at least.
So we also need to address our immigration. I mean, we have that here in the U.S. too.
Yes. So looking at acts of violence against a person, looking at the violence against a child, right? Whether it is rape or no sexual violence, like rape, sexual assault, is a large spectrum of violent acts against a person. Any of that. There is already legislation put in place to deal with it.
It's already illegal, sure. Yeah.
Right. So I don't understand how and who it helps creating more laws, bad laws, that punish indirectly people who sell sex. Prostitution used to be a victimless crime. All criminal law has some sort of moral application, or it springs out of the idea of a moral order. But in the case of prostitution, it's much more nuanced. It's a little bit out of control, out of proportion. And because, like you said earlier, prostitution can't talk about sex workers now, derogatory, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you can degrade them and humiliate them and stigmatize them in other ways, like assigning victimhood to them. Specific type of victimhood.
All of this stuff is sort of ostensibly being done in your name, right? As someone who was trafficked, right?
Absolutely.
That they're literally invoking your story to justify these laws. Does that make you feel, how does that make you feel? Can you talk about that?
First of all, like, I was stunned. I'm like, this, for the way that you're constructing this, this doesn't make sense. Second, you're using something that has happened to me to punish people. That's infuriating, because it's not just about taking someone's experience of, you know, degradation and dehumanization and suffering on so many levels. Like, I don't even want to go into details, but taking that experience, sanitize it, reshape it, and reward it in such a manner to help pass an agenda, a specific political agenda that would benefit a specific group of people at the expense of the rest. That, to me, is not just exploitative, it's criminal. Right? Under the guise of help, it just pushes people farther underground, farther into the hands of real traffickers, whom apparently the government cannot find, in worse positions of poverty, in worse situation. People are going to lose their homes. This will increase, but it's done in my name, in the name of someone like me.
Who's benefiting, do you think, from Sesta Fosta?
There's a group of professionals. When you invent a social problem and you shape public perception around prostitution as trafficking. Right? You demand resources to be allotted to these victims, and you demand professionals to take care of these victims, right? And in the moment you do that, there's an artificial industry that's created, and it has been pretty lucrative for people involved in this. Jonathan Simon has a paper on that with Philly, and they're talking about this group of technocrats with managerial positions that have to justify their jobs.
Mm.
The way they do it is by arresting people, by putting people in jail, putting people in prison, putting people in programs. And in the case of trafficking in the sex industry, police doesn't go after traffickers. Police goes after the most vulnerable street sex workers.
So we're heading into this really dark, terrible time for sex workers. And I think that for sexual expression in general, I mean, one of the side effects of Sestafosta is that companies like Microsoft are now saying, like, you can't talk about sexually explicit things on our platforms. Mm-hmm. Honestly, Skype is one of those platforms, which is where we're using to record this conversation, which some prosecutor could say falls afoul of Sestafosta, God only knows. But what can we do? What can we fucking do right now? I feel honestly like a little helpless, which is why I'm making a show about it, because this is one of the only things I could figure out to do other than yelling about it on Twitter. But are there things that people at home, if they're concerned about this, if they're concerned about the criminalization of sexual expression and sex work, what would you say?
The answer is this. People have to be united. The reason that culture change happened the way it did, it's because these people have a common goal, right? And they have a way of putting the resources together and lobby and have convinced people. This didn't happen in one day. It was 30 years at least of continuous lobbying on systemic attack on the sexual liberation of women, the sexual liberation of everyone. And they research, investing in research and good research is another possibility, but thanks to Bush, that's not necessarily something that is going to happen anytime soon.
What would you want to research if you had all the money?
Ways of discerning between trafficking and voluntary prostitution. Criminal justice reform. I have to remember that criminalization is probably the most extreme form, not probably, definitely the most extreme form of stigmatization. You need to look at why people stigmatize other people and who benefits from stigmatizing human beings, right?
And also, how do we undo stigma once it has already taken root in the culture, I would imagine?
In addition to that, I have to look at how the social movements shaped discourse around prostitution as trafficking and how they silenced other voices. But people have to also take in consideration the well-being that is needed for to achieve these things. Like, you can't fight when you are empty. You can't fight when you're alone, when you don't have a community, when you don't have emotional support to go to. You know, you have to look out for others. You have to build a community in which everyone looks at the common good rather than individual well-being first, right?
Right. And then I would add my own to the list of things people can do is, like, really brass tacks political organizing and voting, right? We need to release the religious rights grip on our government, both federal and state and local governments. And that means we have to address gerrymandering and other forms of voter suppression, which is what keeps them there, because they don't represent the majority of Americans, not in the least. And so I think that getting politically active is part of this as well. Well, I think the community building stuff that you just talked about is so important. And one of the things that we can all do is just sort of be kind and human to each other. and that gets underestimated, the power of that, you know, whether you do that on social media or in person with people or in your own community, like however you define community. But I also think that, like,
right,
we need to be flexing our electoral and political muscles in really organized ways as well.
Yes, it has to be, because like so far nobody really did anything, and these people got so much power and so much recognition. It's just, there's a sickness, and the sickness has to be addressed. Otherwise, it's probably much worse.
Yeah. Well, thanks for spending time explaining it to me and to all my listeners. I really appreciate your perspective and your work and your voice.
Thank you so much. I hope I can help more.
Yeah, absolutely. And tell people how they can follow your work. Do people follow you on Twitter? Or if people want to know more about you and your work, where can they find you?
They can find me on Twitter. And I guess like I have some work that I published, but it's on, I think you can find it on the internet.
And what's your Twitter handle?
If you look for my name, probably I'll show up. So I think it's anarcho-criminology or something like that. I change it often.
All right. You can find me on Twitter also at Jacqueline F, which is JACLYNF. And you can find me on Instagram at Jacqueline Effable. You can find this show wherever podcasts are available, Apple Podcasts, Acast, Stitcher. When you're in there, give us 5 stars, give us a little review. That is how you help other folks find the show. Or you could just also use social media and also just your mouth and tell other people, hey, you should listen to Unscrewed. It's really good. Unscrewed is produced and edited by yours truly, Jacqueline Friedman. Our in and out music is by The Pink Tiles, and our cover art is by Nicole DiDonna and was developed in collaboration with The Establishment, who also developed the sound cues. Until next week, I'm wishing you safe and happy sex lives.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.